Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. I just wrote a trio of long pieces for the newspaper yesterday that looked at something called the fiscal cliff. In short, the cliff refers to a series of big choices facing lawmakers in this country that could lead to sweeping tax increases affecting almost everybody and a series of spending cuts that would affect many of us. If lawmakers can't come to an agreement on exactly what to do, and there are a lot of folks who predict that's exactly what will happen here, all these cuts and tax increases will automatically go into effect. And if that happens, the expectation is that the resulting wallop to the economy would lead to another recession. Yes, it's scary stuff, and all of this decision-making, of course, comes in the midst of a very big presidential campaign. Joining us now to talk about all this is David Wessel. He writes the Capital column for the Wall Street Journal, is a regular contributor to NPR's Morning Edition, and is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He's also the author of a new book just out, Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Later on this hour, we'll talk about some other high-stakes issues, those involving health care in Missouri. But first up, David Wessel, who joins us from the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. And David, good morning. It's nice to have you.
Good morning. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts are about to expire. So is the payroll tax and money that goes into Social Security. Hundreds of millions in spending cuts loom. How did we manage to get in this mess, David?
That's a good question.
Yeah, there you go. 20 seconds
summer,
or less, yeah.
Last summer, Congress raised the debt ceiling, and they decided that in order to get away with doing that, they wanted to do some spending cuts, and they did them. And then they said, we promised to do another $1.2 trillion worth of deficit reduction over the next year. And they set up a committee to do that. And to force the committee to come to a compromise, they said, if we don't get it, we're going to shoot the bullet in the head of the U.S. economy. Well, the committee failed. They're no closer to a compromise. And now we're getting close to the end of December 2012, this year. And these things are going to be triggered unless they find some alternative way to reduce the deficit.
Well, you did that pretty well in about 30 seconds, David, not too badly. You know, the deadline for many of these things, as you just mentioned, is January 1st. But it appears that Congress will, you know, somehow manage to ignore this deadline. How would they get by with doing that?
I'm not sure we know whether they're going to ignore it or not. So we know that after the election, there will be a lame duck session of Congress. I think it's likely if Mitt Romney wins the presidency that they'll call the whole thing off and give him a chance to come up with his own budget. But if President Obama is reelected, I expect he and a group of senators will try and come up with some kind of real deficit deal that will make some meaningful deficit reduction over the long term and allow them to call off this driving the economy off the cliff. And if they can't do that, my guess is they'll come up with some kind of scotch tape thing that makes it look like they have a deal and avoid the cliff. The problem is that at the moment, Washington is pretty polarized. Congress is pretty dysfunctional. And coming together after the election requires everybody to come together with a new attitude. And we sure as hell don't see that yet. You know, going over the cliff is a kind of a tricky thing to explain to people, because if they're really close to a deal, there are things that the Treasury and the White House can do to soften the blow for a couple of weeks. So it's not like the bottom falls out of the economy on January 1st or January 2nd. On the other hand, if they're coming closer and closer to the deadline, I think there will be a lot of anxiety both among the public and among investors, and we may see some really severe gyrations in the financial markets, which could put pressure on them to do something.
And you also wonder at this point, with the presidential race looking, at least today, as if it's a coin flip of a race or getting to be something close to that, if this election is going to really determine that much and send a very clear signal to lawmakers one way or the other.
No, I think you're right. It's very hard at this point, looking at the polls, to see one side dominating the White House and Congress, which means that if we're going to get some kind of serious attack on the future deficits, it's going to require something that members of both parties, at least some of them, vote for. It means some Democrats are going to have to vote for cuts in Medicare, and some Republicans are going to have to vote for raising taxes. And I don't see any way, whether Obama or Romney wins, that you get out of that bind. Now, whether that actually happens is anybody's guess. As you suggested earlier, the temptation of Congress is confronting with a difficult situation that you can put off. They will put it off. They'll find some way to fudge the fiscal cliff, to mix metaphors, and deal with this some other time. But there will be some people who try, and we don't really know who is going to succeed.
Why are some experts in this country so certain, David, that the economy will, in fact, go into recession if the country falls off the cliff?
Well, the people who do those kind of forecasts say if you have a huge increase in taxes and a huge cut in spending on January 1st, you just do the arithmetic. It takes a lot of spending out of the economy on the government side. It takes a lot of spending power out of consumers' pockets on the household side. It's almost inevitable that you get a recession if these things prevail for a whole year. It's kind of an exercise in modeling. But it's a little bit like saying if you run fast for a mile, you don't want to extrapolate that for 5 miles or 10 miles. My guess is that if we do go over the cliff, Congress will do something to pull us back. So that those projections are kind of a warning, but they're not really a crystal ball that I would put a lot of faith in. But if I can just add one thing, they are already having an effect. If you're a business person and you're thinking about hiring or investing, and you say, okay, I read all these things in the paper about the Congressional Budget Office and all these economists say, if we go over the cliff, we have a recession. I look at Congress, I look at the presidential race, they seem to be more capable of arguing with each other than compromising. I think that they're going to go over the cliff. I think maybe I'll just hold off on orders for new equipment or hiring now. So I think there are indications that this is already hurting the economy, even though we're not yet to the precipice of the cliff.
You know, it is just amazing to me, astounding actually, that as we sit here talking about this, that the Congress of this country has allowed this situation to devolve into the situation we're in right now, where we're facing this potential economic catastrophe, in a sense, just weeks from now, if Congress can't get its act together and do something in the meantime. This is just unbelievable to me.
No, I can't add much to that. I think it reflects a couple of things. One, it reflects the polarization of the society and Congress over what to do about this. Two, it reflects the inability of Democrats and Republicans to agree on almost everything. I sometimes think they can't even agree on the metaphor. Some people say we go over the cliff. Some people say we hit the cliff. Some people say it's really a fiscal slope. One group in Washington is calling it a fiscal obstacle course. I mean, you can't even get your metaphor straight.
I wrote about this weekend, and I was struggling with exactly those questions as I was writing my pieces. Yeah.
And then the third thing is, you know, this is hard. This is really hard. In my book, Red Ink, I talk favorably about the Congressional Budget Office, and I write about Doug Elmendorf, who's the economist who runs it. And he has this way of summing up the deficit in a single sentence that I think really puts it well. There's a fundamental disconnect between the benefits that Americans want from the government, particularly for the elderly, and the tax revenues they're willing to send to the government.
Mm.
And that problem, that divide, makes it hard to solve. It's not like you can flick some switch or, you know, make a little tweak. To fix the problem, we have to make some pretty serious changes and some pretty big choices.
Hmm.
Congress thought that they could force it themselves to make those choices by putting this horrible disaster at the end of the year if they didn't make it. One of the senators on the Democratic side to whom I spoke recently said, well, I learned my lesson there. Next time when we do one of these things, the fail-safe is going to be something we can actually live with. And so that if we fail to come to agreement, we get something that at least is good for the country rather than something that would be horrible.
Oh, that's amazing. You know, I just noticed that the head of Goldman Sachs, of all places, has come out and urged Congress to settle things. And in an amazing thing to say for the head of a company like Goldman Sachs, he said if it takes a tax increase to do it, by all means do it. Just get this set of decisions out of the way. What kinds of effect do statements like that have on members of Congress, David?
We don't really know. There's a bunch of business people, the CEOs of UPS, of Caterpillar, of Federal Express, Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, the money management firm, who are have contributed money and who are organizing around a campaign that was really spawned by Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, the Democrat and Republican who chaired a deficit reduction panel that the president appointed. And they're hoping to kind of explain to members of Congress that doing nothing here is the wrong thing to do. I do think that when big business types, particularly ones who are rich, say, if you cut spending, I am willing to pay more in taxes individually. Most of them don't say they're willing to have their firms pay more in taxes, but they're willing to see an increase in individual taxes. That does create a climate in which it's easier, although not easy, to do a deal after the election or next year. When I've spoken to a number of business audiences, and now, you know, if you speak to a group of 400 businessmen or 500 businessmen, most conferences now have these little handheld devices, sometimes an iPad, sometimes something that looks like a BlackBerry, where people can vote. Mm-hmm. And you pose a question, and in most of the ones I've done, and I've done maybe three or four, so it's not a huge number, if you ask people, are you willing to pay more taxes if there's spending cuts in order to get the country back on fiscal sanity, about 75 to 80% say yes. And if you ask them if they expect a tax increase, it's almost universal. So I think the business community and the markets are kind of braced for an increase in taxes because they see that that's the only way to get anything through Congress that would make a reasonable dent in the deficit.
Hmm. Well, if our listeners have questions about what this fiscal cliff might mean for them going forward and where Congress is on all of this, you can give us a phone call right now. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. So I guess, again, the bottom line here is it sounds like, at least for many Americans, the central issue is we want certain benefits from the government, but to some extent, we're not willing to pay for it.
Right. I think that's the fundamental underlying problem that makes a deficit so hard to fix. I mean, look, the deficit, despite the numbers, is not really a big economic problem today. The big problem we have today is there's not enough jobs and we have still very high unemployment. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, it's come down a little, but we still have very high. But if you look out to the future, we have made promises to pay benefits, particularly but not only to the elderly, to farmers, to veterans, to people who bought our bonds. We've made promises to make payments that far exceed the revenues that are going to come in under the existing tax code under any reasonable economic scenario. As a result, we're like we are running up a bigger debt every year. You know, when you get your credit card bill, there's that little box that say if you make the minimum monthly payment, you'll mm-hmm. be able to pay off this debt in 237 months or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what we are kind of doing. And unfortunately for us, much of the borrowing we do now, about half the federal government's borrowing, is done from abroad, particularly from China and from Japan. So each year, more and more of our national income goes to pay interest. We're not paying down the principal, goes to pay interest on our debt. And that money doesn't go to bondholders in the U.S. It goes to the Chinese and the Japanese. Last year, it was 6% of all federal spending went to interest. In 5 years, the president's budget projects, even if the economy is healthy and even if Congress took every one of the president's suggestions, the ones that he made in his budget, it would be 12% of federal spending in interest. So it's kind of gnawing away at the foundations of our economy.
Yeah, I was going to say the government last year spent $230 billion just on interest. That's the same number you just were talking about there.
Right, and that's more than the combined budgets of the Departments of Education, Commerce, Homeland Security, Interior, State, Justice, and the federal courts thrown in.
Man,
and that's in a time when interest rates are extraordinarily low, lower than they've been any time in the last 100 years or more. And so when interest rates return to normal, as they surely will someday, the interest tab is going to go up. It's like the U.S. has a giant adjustable rate mortgage, and it knows that rates are going to be higher in the future than they are today.
Well, a billion here and a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. At least some famous person once said that. Again, our
Everett Dirksen.
Everett Dirksen, sure. But he said a million here and a million
there.
True. I think we've changed over the years. Now it's billions.
If you ever get it, you should look. If you search that on YouTube, watching him say that is one. It makes Saturday Night Live look dull. It's very funny.
816-235-2888 is our phone number. Our topic today, the fiscal cliff and what it might mean for you. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Let's go to Dave from Overland Park. Dave, you're on the program. Good morning.
Good morning. One of the issues that we're talking about here, I think, is the effect of taxes And one of the big questions is whether reducing taxes is going to stimulate growth. And a large part of the electorate just assumes that it always is going to stimulate growth. But history has really suggested otherwise, and yet nobody seems paying attention to that. And the big landmark in this subject was a study done by Douglas Holtz Eakin, the bona fide economist that was at the CBO at the time. He came from the Bush White House to head the CBO. And as soon as he got there, he started a long six-month study that was reported in the Wall Street Journal of the effect of the Bush tax cuts and whether they would pay for themselves by stimulating growth. The bottom line of the study was that at no point in the next 10 years would those tax cuts pay for themselves, come even close to themselves. And yet, this, rather than being talked about, this has been forgotten about. And I don't understand why there's all this clamor for cutting taxes to stimulate growth when the evidence that I know of says just the opposite. The taxes are already so low that a further cut is not going to do anything. Why is this being ignored?
I think you're mixing up two things. I don't think there's any argument that lower taxes tend, in general, to stimulate growth. What Doug Holtz Eakin did at the Congressional Budget Office and others have done since is say that they don't stimulate enough growth to produce enough revenue to pay for themselves. And that's a difference. I mean, we know that when times are tough, when we have a recession, that tax cuts put more money in people's pockets, and that tends to increase demand. And so there's a little bit faster economic growth than there would be otherwise. And we also know that if there are things that the tax code does that are kind of crazy and counterproductive, and that's kind of what Governor Romney is arguing, that if they change the tax code and in his current iteration of his not fleshed out campaign promises on taxes, he says that he's not talking about a net tax cut. He's talking about moving around the boxes in the tax code in ways that will encourage more of what we want, savings and investment, and less of things that we don't want, a whole lot of people spending a lot of time and money to game the tax code because we've got it so complicated.
Dave, thank you for the call. Let's go to Lou from Lawrence. Lou, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I have two questions or slash comments. One is that it seems like this pants on fire stuff about the deficit has been going on for 50 years. Is it just the magnitude of it now that's so important? I don't really understand why it's such a why there's this qualitative craziness about what's going to happen January 1st, other than the sequestration thing. The second comment is, why in the world, I hope you're not an economist, but why in the world would we believe these economists? They're half right and half wrong. And, you know, and it's not the same guys who are half right and half wrong all the time. They're all wrong, and they're all right half the time. It's like not science. So I'm just looking for some answers.
Why is it different now? Yeah.
On the half right, half wrong, the trick is to pick the economists with whom you agree and cite them. That's the secret to that one. it is the magnitude that is the issue. You know, for a time in the late 90s, we had a balanced budget. At the beginning of the 2000s, the federal debt as a percentage of the size of the economy was about 30-35%. Today, just a decade or a little more later, it's about 70%. And we know looking forward, precisely because of the demographics, the number of people turning 65 who will be collecting Social Security and who will be covering Medicare, that the demands on the federal government will grow over time. When I came to Washington in the late 80s, they talked about how important it was to do something about Social Security and Medicare before the baby boom retired. Well, they did a few little things, but now the baby boomers are retiring. Over the next decade, the number of people over 65 will grow by one-third. 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day now. And so the short answer is, A, it's the magnitude, and B, it's the inexorable demographics that mean we have to do something about it. It does not mean, though, that we have to cut the deficit abruptly and do it all by Friday afternoon. In fact, that would be economic suicide. And when you listen to the wise counsel of the International Monetary Fund, they're cautioning countries to fix their budgets, but do it gradually and over a period of time. Well, if you're going to do something over a decade, you kind of got to get started sooner or later. And that's what the pants on fire is. It's time to get started.
Let's go to Dennis from Kansas City, Missouri. Dennis, you're on Up to Date. Our guest today, again, David Wessel, author of Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Go ahead, Dennis.
Very interesting discussion. One point that I see that everyone seems to be just dancing around and skipping over is the GDP. Calling ourselves in a recession is based directly off the GDP, yet we keep shipping jobs overseas, and we've got our GDP down to housing starts and new cars. And with that, we seem to be putting our eggs in one basket, or two, as it were. And, you know, that just kind of leaves us with who out there flipping burgers is going to be able to afford a car or a house. Hmm. And I mean, we're trying to get jobs going here. And with the free trade agreements as they are, American companies can go overseas and take advantage of it. It seems to me the whole idea was to give our companies new markets to deal to. Rather, we ended up with our markets becoming their markets. Hmm. And it seems to me that if a CEO wants to be in charge of a company that takes advantage of, say, a trade deal with Mexico, then that CEO ought to live there.
Right.
And if it was an American company, then those goods ought to be made in America.
Dennis, thank you. Let's get a response here. Does he have a point, David?
Well, let's set aside how we measure GDP, because that's not really what he's talking about. What he's talking about is something fundamentally wrong with the U.S. economy, and have American workers as a whole and consumers been hurt by international trade? It is true that we've seen a hollowing out of the middle class. Those factory jobs that used to pay $25, $30, $50 an hour seem to have been under a lot of pressure, and much of it because of trade. That's true. But we do know a couple things. Exports are up quite a bit. So some of these trade agreements are actually seem to be doing as designed to increase our exports. We do know that I believe, not everybody does, that we can prosper alongside the Chinese. If everybody plays fair, there's enough to go around, and we can benefit from trade. And finally, I think that, you know, manufacturing jobs have come back a little bit, but let's not dump too hard on these service sector jobs. Most people in America do not work in manufacturing or construction. Most people work in services. And a lot of those are good jobs, adding value, making good wages. They're not all hamburger flipper jobs. Writing code for Microsoft is a service sector job. Being a skilled journalist like you are is a service sector job. And we don't necessarily want to all go back to working on machines or using hose and think that would be progress.
Hmm. You know, there's one group that's been operating and working on this, David, is the Gang of Six, six senators been meeting. They met on this, the deficit issue, a year ago. What kind of progress are they making? Are you seeing any movement on these issues as January 1st inches closer here?
Well, the Gang of Six, and let's kind of expand a little bit, it's probably mm-hmm. more like 8 or 10 now, are a group of senators, some Democrats, some Republicans, who are hoping that if they can among themselves put together a deficit reduction plan that they can agree to, and then they can stand up as a group of bipartisan group, that will catch fire. I think they're working very hard, and I suspect that they will try and do something after the lame duck. But there are two things we know. Well, there's more than two. Three things we know. One, they're having a hard time coming up with a plan. They've been at work at this for a long time. Two, it's not clear how many other senators will actually sign on when we get to that point. And three, and this is the big one, it's far from clear what the Republicans in the House will do if a bunch of senators stand up and say, we got a deal here. It involves raising taxes as well as cutting benefits. And before the election, we'll never know how many House Republicans, and they'll need some of their votes, will stand up for that. So if we get a big deal at the end of the year or early next year, then reporters like me will go back and say the seeds were planted with the Gang of Six when they met in Senator Mark Warner's office in, you know, January 2011. And if we don't get a deal, we'll say this is just one more vain attempt to cut a deal that was unrealistic and overly idealistic and it didn't produce anything. So we don't know if it's going to do anything until we get to the end of the story.
We received this email, David. What does the fiscal cliff mean for someone just past retirement age with a portfolio of mutual funds? Is it okay to stay put and ride out this cliffhanger, or do changes need to be made to investments and soon?
Well, I usually try not to give investment advice. If I were good at that, I wouldn't be a reporter
man,
for the Wall Street Journal. I'd be a subscriber.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the one thing to remember is that that whatever happens around the fiscal cliff is going to be almost certain to temporary. The market may go down, the market may go up, but everybody knows it's coming. If there's a big, you know, gridlock in Congress, it may hurt the market. If they cut a deal, it may help the market. But it's hard to imagine that a year from now that this will have been the big determining effect in how the markets go. That's much more likely to be determined by what's going on with corporate profits, what's going on with the pace of global growth and stuff like that. So I think, my general investment advice is things like don't panic, don't put all your eggs in one basket, and mm-hmm. so forth. And that's about as far as I'm willing to go.
You know, you've got some absolutely fascinating facts about federal spending in your book, Red Ink. One of them is this, and this one just, I guess, caught me by surprise. The U.S. defense budget is greater than the combined defense budgets of the next 17 largest spenders. I'm talking about China, the U.K., France, Russia, Japan, Saudi Arabia, Germany, Italy, Brazil, South Korea, Canada, Turkey, Australia, and there are others. I guess I didn't realize that was where we stood here.
Right. I mean, you can't do anything about the federal budget on the spending side without dealing with at least two things. One is healthcare spending, which is growing faster than anything else.
Yeah.
And the other is the size of the defense budget. And we have to make some choices. Everybody wants to have a defense budget that's big enough to protect us from missiles from North Korea or cyber attacks from China or Iran. And we know we have we want to keep the sea lanes open for the oil we import and so forth. But I think there are big questions to be answered about how much defense budget is enough and to what extent can the U.S. continue to be the cops of the world, because it's now 20% of all federal spending. And as you point out, our defense budget is more than the next 17 defense budgets combined.
Man. This was also interesting to me. If you fired every federal government employee, that wouldn't save enough to even cut the deficit in half.
Right. So we spent $435 billion last year on government employees' wages and salaries, and that's a lot of money. But the fact is our deficits are over $1 trillion a year, and that most of the money the federal government collects does not go to pay federal government employees, military, civilian, bureaucrat, park ranger, the rest of them. It comes in the federal government and then it goes out again, either in the form of benefits or some of it in state and local government grants or some of it in government contracts. And the reason that's important is because, A, we're not going to solve this problem. We're not going to bring the spending and revenue lines closer together by eliminating departments of the federal government or squeezing a lot of federal employees' salaries. It's just not enough of the money. If we're going to really seriously tackle this problem over the next decade, someone is going to pay more taxes, and someone is going to get less in benefits. It's not only going to be the government employees that get the squeeze.
Well, and speaking of paying taxes, you also say this, David, the share of income most American families pay in federal taxes has been falling for more than 30 years. Today, Americans pay less of their income in taxes than citizens of nearly every other developed country.
Right.
Wow.
So I think people sometimes misunderstand federal taxes. They think they're paying more than they are.
Yeah.
The fact is that that for the families in the middle of the middle class, the share of their income that goes to income, payroll, excise, and other federal taxes has actually been falling since 1979. We've been able to get away with that and spend more money two ways. One is more of the money's coming from people at the top who have had more money, so they've paid more taxes. And we've borrowed a lot. 36 cents of every dollar we spent in 2011 was borrowed, and that's not sustainable.
Hmm. Beth writes in with this suggestion: we should come up with an organization via electronic media with the assistance of folks like Warren Buffett, Mort Zuckerman, and other big business but moderate social issue gentlemen who should take over the financial decision-making from our elected members of Congress who are either hostage to their no-compromise bases or irresponsibly obstructionist on their own.
Well, I still have a bit of affection for democracy.
Just
I
a little bit.
So I'm as frustrated as any citizen by what I've seen in Congress. And It definitely seems less functional than it was in earlier times of my career in Washington. But I don't think we want to abandon this yet. It's kind of scary to me. I've heard a number of people say things like this. We ought to have an independent commission. It ought to be like the Federal Reserve Board. Or we're never going to get anywhere until we have we turn ourselves into Italy or Spain or something like that. You know, I hope that's not the case. There are a number of members of Congress, maybe not the majority yet, who think we ought to do something about this. And I do think that there will be some backlash from the public, if not from the financial markets, if they continue to fiddle while the national fiscal situation gets worse and worse.
Well, David, I sure enjoyed having you. Thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's David Wessel. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. That book, now out. The timing of that book, very good, given what this country's up against the next few weeks.